I call your attention this morning to Psalm 85. Psalm 85. The title of the message today is A Song for America. The songs that the choir has sung today have been wonderful. I don't think any of us can doubt that God has been good to America. When I think about growing up in this country, I really believe that I have been a blessed man. I don't know, I guess maybe because of the time in which I grew up. I was born in 56. Now, to some of our young people, that's ancient. That was just after Moses, crossed the Red Sea. And I'm kind of ancient to some of these young folks. But it's not really that long ago in my mind. I still remember saying the Pledge of Allegiance at school. I still remember singing songs like America the Beautiful. And I'm telling you, I think that we have been spoiled in this country. Sometimes when I'm around a group of young people, I'll ask this question. Would you rather be alive today, or would you rather have been the King of England in 1600? Whenever in 1611, we had King James in England. If you could choose to be a king then or a teenager now, what would you choose? You think about that, you adults that are sitting here. Would you rather go back to some point in history and be able to live a long, full life or be alive today? Can I tell you that every person in this room today, you have it better than King James had it? You think about this for a moment. One of the things that really frosts me is when people talk about how bad it is in this country. They'll say things like this: we've got so many people below the poverty line. The only problem is the people in our poverty live like kings compared to the rest of the world. You say, well, what do you think about some of the politicians that are out there today talking about we need to be more socialist? Any of you want to move to Venezuela? You want to go down there where it's not what you're going to eat, it's if you're going to eat? When you go to other countries such as Cuba, do you want to trade that 2016 pickup truck that you're driving in? Oh, you say, it's old. It's 3 years old. Yeah, well, what about if you had to drive a 1957 Ford, which is what they drive in Cuba, if it works? I don't know about you, but I like having a cell phone. I remember when we didn't have cell phones. I'd have to get out in the middle of January and answer a beeper and make a payphone call. And it was usually one of my kids saying, hey, Dad, would you bring us a pizza home? I like cell phones. Can I tell you something? I like going to the bathroom inside a house. Okay? I like driving a nice truck. I'd hate to know that I had to ride a horse from here to Atlanta. But yet that's exactly what was taking place less than 100 years ago. Let me ask you a question. How many of you hear people today talk about all them drug companies? Them drug companies are bad. Well, how would you like to live without antibiotics? How would you like to live with no medicine? In New Testament times, basically the medicine that they had, olive oil. Yet Today, we take blood pressure medicine. We got a bunch of you take water pills. You say, how do you know? Because some of you have to get up and go during church. All right? Some of you go, man, I'm telling you, I get headaches every day. I got to buy some Excedrin. Well, what about if you didn't have Excedrin? You think about all the amenities that we have in this country that they don't have in other countries. You just think about that kind of stuff. And so when somebody comes along and they say, hey, we need to be more like Venezuela. Everybody's got health care. Yeah, none. We need to be more like Canada. They have free surgery. Yeah, and you got to wait 8 months to get it. We need to make those doctors basically practice for free. Yeah, you get what you pay for. Let me tell you something. I don't want a lunatic for a lawyer. I don't want a quack for a doctor. I tell you something else I don't want. I don't want a modernist for a Bible teacher. I want to love the Lord. I want to love my Bible. And I want to love my country because God's been good to this country. And you and I need to realize that. And when somebody wants to come and they want to flip it, you need to say, no, no. God has blessed us because we have been a certain way. We've given people the freedom to worship God according to their consciences. Can I tell you that's a Baptist distinctive? That's something that Baptists have fought for since New Testament times. I believe that you ought to have the right to worship God as you see fit. But can I tell you that with that decision comes a responsibility and you'll answer to God for it? But yet you don't have to violate your conscience. If I don't worship like the guy down the street, I don't think I should have to worry about the government coming in and arresting me because they like him better. Everybody ought to have the freedom to express themselves. And those are things that we have in this country. You know what they're called? They're called unalienable rights. That's one of the reasons that I like the preamble to the Declaration of Independence. Let me just read it to you. We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal, that they are endowed by their Creator. You know what? I get the idea that our forefathers, whenever they were crafting the Declaration and the Constitution, and really the constitutions for the states, you get the idea that they believed in God. Right? There's not any of this atheistic stuff. It wasn't any agnostic stuff. It was like they may not agree on maybe the way God thought, but they knew there was a Creator and they gave him credit for it, and that rights came from him. They were by law natural rights, not given by the government. If the government gives them, the government can take them. And so they are endowed by their Creator with certain unalienable rights, that among these are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. Notice they didn't say happiness, they said the pursuit of happiness. You get to try to be happy according to the decisions that you make. But just because you want a big screen TV don't mean that a taxpayer needs to pay for it. If you want a big screen TV, go get you a job. Some of you grew up in a time whenever you would have one of your parents say something like this: "Hey, Tom, I noticed that you're, you know, kind of paying attention to the girls." "Yes, sir." "Said maybe you'd like to maybe go get a hamburger with one of them." "Well, yeah, that'd be pretty good." "Go get a job, you can pay for it." That's the kind of the era. So in other words, what do you get? What kind of happiness you get? The kind that you create. But you've got the right to do it. Do you know if you're not happy in Georgia, you can move to Florida? I don't know why you'd want to do that. I mean, if you can't be happy in Georgia, you got a happy problem. You got mountains in the north, and you got beach in the south, and little hills in between. You got freezing cold winter in the wintertime. You got hot, hot summertime. You got about anything you want here in Georgia. You got good seafood. You got good hunting. You got good fishing. You got good churches. So I don't know why anybody would want to leave the promised land here in Georgia and move somewhere else. But you've got that right. And so we are blessed here in this country. Now, I want us to get to our text this morning. I want you to look with me at Psalm 85. There's no doubt in my mind that this psalm has a twofold meaning to it. There's two ways to apply it. When you read this psalm, you'll see that it is not a psalm of David. I believe that it comes after David's time. Now, we talk about David writing the psalms, but he did not write all of them. There are quite a few that he did not pen. This is one of those psalms. This is a psalm for the sons of Korah. This was a group of men that formed a choir. And they were the official singers, and there were probably more than one group of the sons of Korah. And the word sons there is like sons of the prophets. It has the idea of a group of people of like faith, all right, of like belief. A son of a prophet or sons of the prophets in the Old Testament was basically a bunch of college kids. They were at Bible colleges. Here you've got the sons of Korah, and this is like a group of men that are in a choral group, all right? And so you have a psalm for these men, and we see there's really two phases that we can apply this. The first phase comes from when the Babylonian captivity is over. Now, what took place with the Babylonian captivity? What you had is you had the Babylonians that came in and they conquered the south. 100 years plus prior, the north had already been conquered by the Assyrians. But Nebuchadnezzar came in and he conquered the south. And Jeremiah and Daniel, the prophet, prophesied that they would be in captivity for 70 years. 70 years has now passed. And Cyrus, who was a Persian, has now defeated the Babylonians. And so he gives them the right to go back from the Babylonian or Chaldean area, go back to the land of promise. And so in this first group, you have 60,000 that do that. That's the first group that goes back to Israel. Now, there'll be another group that will go later. But when they get there, what do they see? They see nothing but debris everywhere. The walls of the city have fallen down. 70 years of trees and growth have grown through the rocks that had been pulled off of each other. It is a desolate place. And this is where these people are going back to. Not only do they see the desolation, but the people that are in the surrounding area, people like the Samaritans, they don't want them there. But yet this is the land of promise. And so we see Israel has been brought back. And so I want us to look at three things, and I'll try to make application to our country as we go through these three things this morning. The first thing that I want you to remember is this, that this is a prayer or a song for revival. Keep that in mind as an umbrella underneath these 3 points. If there's anything that we need in this country today, in our country, we need a revival. We need to have an awakening to the to the ways of God. There needs to be a fear of God. There's not much fear today of God. There's not much fear today of any authority. It doesn't matter where you go in this country, there's somebody that's balking at authority. Can I tell you that if there's no authority and anarchy reigns, that's trouble? A law-abiding electorate is a good thing because it gives order. That's why Romans 13 talks about those that are in authority over you. Can I tell you the police are good? Amen. 3 or 4 years ago, I think it was, we had what we called a Back to Blue Sunday. Does that mean that 100% of all the police officers in this country are good? No. But 100% of all preachers aren't good either. 100% of all doctors and lawyers and whatever your profession is, they're not good either. I remember years ago, I had an uncle, and he was always kind of trying to, you know, trying to goad me a little bit. I'm about 19 years old, and, you know, I'm doing my best to try to live for God, and, you know, I'm not exactly the, you know, brightest bulb in the chandelier, and, you know, and he's trying to needle me a little bit, and so he goes, "Hey, what do you think about your buddy Jimmy?" Jimmy who? Jimmy Baker. That guy's selling condominiums. He's selling the same one to multiple people. They locked him up. Isn't that the way all preachers are? I said, "Have you ever had anything stolen from Moody Air Force Base?" That's where he worked. And he goes, "Well, yeah." I said, "I guess everybody that works out there is a thief. How much have you stole recently?" He goes, "I ain't stole nothing." I said, "All preachers aren't bad either." I said, "Just because you got one or two." I said, "Don't generalize. If you generalize about my chosen profession, I can generalize about your life." And so you've got this psalm, and it's an umbrella. And there's three things that I want us to see this morning quickly. Number one, I want you to see their past in mind, their recent past. Look at verse 1. "Lord, thou hast been favorable unto thy land." The word "hast" there is in the past tense. You've looked back in the past and you've seen how that you have been favorable in past times. And now we're back and you hast brought the captivity of Jacob back into the land. So they're looking at things that God has done in their recent past. Why did they go into captivity in the first place? Because of sin? Because of transgressing the law of God? Because of iniquity that abounded in the hearts of the people? I mean, you would have a bad king, and then there would be a good king. And after the good king, there'd be a bad king. And that's mainly in the south. In the north, it was mainly bad, 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 maybe one good, then all of bad again. And so you've got these kings that are good, bad, mostly bad, and it was trending that way. And Jeremiah says, "Don't do that." And they go, "Shut up." And he begins to prophesy. And for a generation, he's saying, "Trouble's coming. The hand of God is going to fall on us." We don't want to hear that. We'd rather listen to this prophet. We like what he says better. And so you've got their past. And what does God do? God lets them go into captivity. But now, because they're his people, he chooses to bring them back in the land after a time of chastisement. Can I tell you that I hope America's days are not numbered? This country was the leading exporter of the gospel, literally for decades upon decades. In the early 1900s, it was Great Britain. But from somewhere around probably about 1920, really through about 1990, in that 70-year span, nobody sent more missionaries around the world than America. We exported the gospel to all kind of places. But can I tell you, we're no longer number one? I read statistically that we're somewhere around number six or seven now on the nation's list of sending the gospel around the world. Can I tell you that I want God to bless this country again? I want God to raise up a generation of these young people like we have sitting to my right. And I want them, come hell or high water, to say, I will serve God no matter the cost. And I pray that that will be the heartbeat of these young people. And I want their minds to be focused on the Lord. And I want God to not just let them live in the past. But can I tell you that I do not want them to live in the past, but I don't want to live in the past. I want to look at what God did with me 40 years ago. I want God to do something with me tomorrow. I don't want God to just give me the memories of what happened 25 years ago. I want God to do something next week. I want God to take some of these kids that'll come to VBS a week from tonight. And I want them to just simply give their lives to the Lord and just live for Him. Yesterday, I took my grandson over to a baseball practice. And there was a little guy that was there, and he's hurt his hand. And I know his family. And I walked by the dugout, and he was there. And I went over and I said, hey, four. He turned around, and I called his name. And I said, I want to tell you something. He looked at me like, uh-oh, what did I do? I said, I sure have been proud of you in the last week. He said, really? I said, yeah. I said, you know why? He goes, I said, because about two weeks ago on Father's Day, I heard you got baptized. And he goes, yeah, I did. And I said, you know what? That does this old heart good, knowing that there's little guys like you that still have a heart for Jesus. And I said, don't ever lose that. He goes, okay. And I walked off and he turned around just shaking his head, you know. And so I'm looking forward to these kids at VBS. I'm looking forward to seeing long-lasting results from our junior camp last week. We had a little technical difficulty this morning. We were going to show a junior camp video, and maybe we'll do that, but somehow the file was either bothered or something. By the way, let me just throw this in now before I forget it. We had two people yesterday that I know of. Did any of you get an email asking me, or say, supposedly from me, asking you to buy something? Okay, so good. It's not rampant, all right? But we had at least two people that called me and said, Pastor, can I ask you a question? I said, sure. Do you want me to buy something for the church? And I said, what are you talking about? And they're like, well, we got an email that said, hey, this is Pastor Tom. Would you buy this for the church? Can I tell you, if you get something like that via email, somebody's messing with you? If I want you to buy something for the church, I'll just ask you. I'll call you on the phone and there won't be any doubt who it is. You'll know it's me if I need you to do something like that. But don't believe an email. I just want to throw that out there. You say, you think you got hacked? I have no idea. But I can tell you Macedonia Mission got hacked about 3 weeks ago. Hackers came in, took all of their files, encrypted them, and they have been working around the clock now for over 2 weeks trying to get everything put back. You know what the FBI told them? Pay the ransom. Pay the ransom. I'm thinking, you don't negotiate with terrorists. You don't negotiate with ransom people, with hackers. You know, and so anyway, I just want to throw that out there in case you get an email this week. It's not from me. I don't care that my name's on it. it's not from me. So, back to our first point. They were praising God for his past favor. They were praising God, look at verse 2, for forgiveness. Thou hast forgiven the iniquity of thy people and hast covered all of their sin. You know, these people understood exactly what this was a reference to. On Yom Kippur, which is the Day of Atonement, the high priest would have two goats. They would have one goat, and the high priest would take his hands and he would put his hands on that goat's head, and then they would give it to a man that was in good shape. In other words, they wouldn't give it to me. All right. You know, I mean, I walk about 200 yards and I'm done. All right. But they would give it to some guy that was really, I mean, he could go. And he would lead that goat way away out into the wilderness. And he would let that goat loose and he would just be gone to wander and nobody could find him anymore. Why? Because he was called the scapegoat. All of the sins of Israel were placed upon his head and he was sent away and he was a scapegoat. The other goat they would take and they would sacrifice him. They would cut its throat. They would take the blood, and that was the blood that they would lay on the mercy seat. And it would cover the nation's blood for a year. That word's important. When you read in the Old Testament about sin being covered, what would you have? Adam and Eve sinned. God made a sacrifice. Their sins were covered. Noah, he sinned, made a sacrifice. Adam's sins were added to Noah's sins. They were covered. And you do that every year, and every year that heap of sins got higher and higher. I mean, it was deep. But then all of a sudden, John the Baptist said, "Behold the Lamb of God that takes away the sin of the world." Jesus' blood didn't cover the sin. It got it vanished. I mean, in the omnipotence and the omniscience of God, the blood of Christ cleansed from all sin. No sin. You don't have it covered anymore. The blood of Christ forgives and it's gone. And so their sins had been covered and they were praising God for that. I want you to know that I think because of America's goodness, God blessed this country. Back in the late 1800s, there was a French philosopher named Alexis de Tocqueville. And they asked him to speak at various places. And one of the things that he would say is this, and I'm paraphrasing, but he would say, "When I went to America to find her greatness, I went to the great cities, and then I went to the farmlands. And I looked and I saw all the vastness and all the beauty of that great country." He said, "But it was not until I went into the churches of America that I truly saw her greatness." And you've got this French philosopher that was well steeped in what was called the Age of Enlightenment, where you had French people having their heads cut off on a daily basis because of that enlightenment. God was nowhere to be found in France, but yet here in America, you've got a whole different philosophy. We are free because God gave us unalienable rights. Nobody can take our life just because they want to. If they do, they lose their life. Nobody can stop us from trying to pursue our happiness because God gave us that right. It's a natural right. It didn't come from Washington, D.C. It didn't come from Atlanta. It came from God. And so you've got America. Oh, and America was a righteous nation at one time. At one time, you had about 80% of Americans that were in church almost every Sunday. Can I tell you it's probably about 10% now, if that? At one time, you had people that were all in for God. I heard one of our presidents, Teddy Roosevelt say this. I say I heard him say it. I read that he said it. Teddy Roosevelt said this when somebody asked him, he said, why do you attend church? Do you agree with everything that the pastor says? He said, no. He said, but I don't think that it's going to do me any harm. He says, matter of fact, it'll probably do me good. When a good man stands up and reads from the Bible, that's going to make me a better man instead of a worse man. And he said, that's why I choose to go to church. That's the kind of thinking that was in our past. That's a far cry from what you hear on places like CNN and MSNBC and Fox nowadays. And so we see the past. There's a second thing, and that is their present need. Look with me at verse 4. Turn us, O God, of our salvation, and cause thine anger toward us to cease. Wilt thou be angry with us forever? Wilt thou draw out thine anger to all generations? And pay attention to this. Wilt thou not revive us again, that thy people may rejoice in thee? Can I tell you that the word revive is a beautiful word? We get our word revival from it. What does it mean? It means to basically to perk up. It means to give life, to give encouragement. Do you remember old Jacob in Genesis 45? He had loved that young boy Joseph, but those older brothers had taken him and they had sold him into slavery. They had taken that coat of many colors, they put some animal's blood on it, and they told old Jacob, hey, he's dead. Oh, but when those guys were hungry and Jacob sent those boys to Egypt, little did they know that number two in all of Egypt after a long journey was that baby brother they thought was dead. And all of a sudden, they found out who he was and they were scared. And Joseph looked at them and he said, you meant it for evil, but God meant it for good. And he said, I want you to go and tell my daddy that I'm alive. Now, old Jacob's an old man. He's about to die. His heart's been broken because he thought that youngest boy had been killed by some animal. But the Bible tells us in Genesis 45 that when he heard the words of Joseph, it said, Jacob revived. In other words, he got up and he was like, he's alive? He had an energy that he had not had before. Why? Because God had given him information that he thought was never going to happen. And can I tell you that you and I ought to seek revival personally? We ought to want God to do something in our life if he doesn't do it with anybody else at all. But if I want him to do something in my life, and you want him to do something in your life, and somebody else wants him to do something in their life, if we get enough of us together, then God will do something collectively. And you have these people, and it's like, Lord, are you going to be angry with us forever? They know that he's not, because he's already brought them out of captivity. And they said in verse 7, Lord, show us mercy. Show us mercy, O Lord. Grant us thy salvation. I want God's mercy on this country. And I'm fearful. I really am. When I think about 60 million babies that have been aborted, when I think about people like the governor of Virginia that made a statement, and he tried to crawl at it, but he made the statement, said, well, I think that if there's a baby that's aborted and is born alive, they just ought to sit it over to the side, and if the mother and the doctor decide that it doesn't need to live, then they can just maybe, you know, gently just inject it. And somebody says, do you really believe that people think that way? He said it. What about the General Assembly in the state of New York. They voted that it was okay to go ahead and kill babies that were born alive, even if they survived partial birth abortion. And when they voted it, what did they do? They gave themselves a standing ovation. We are a confused people. We call evil good and good evil. I put this, I think, in the Friday Blast. Did you know that there are 63 genders that are now recognized in this country? I'm going to tell you right now, I always thought it was just male and female. I never have met 61 others. Can I tell you that 40 years ago, people that believed like that, it was a mental disorder? You go, yeah, but times have changed. You know who's got the mental disorders now? Bible believers. Yeah, and I'm going to keep being crazy. It doesn't matter what happens. You just keep believing the book, folks, because in the end, you win. And so they saw their present need. Oh, they still needed God to help them. We need mercy. Let me give you the last thing. Their preparation for revival. How did they prepare? Well, we see this beginning in verse number 8, and it's very simple. It says, I will hear what the Lord will speak. In other words, I'll just listen to God. I mean, he's smarter than all of us. And so I'll just listen to the Lord. Then he says that, don't turn again into folly. In other words, I'm going to listen to the Lord, but Lord, don't let Israel, don't let the house of Jacob, don't let them begin to follow the pagans again. And if God ever comes to us and visits with us with his showers of blessings again, let's not take that for granted, folks. These people had just kind of come out of a time of chastisement. And this psalmist is saying, Lord, don't let us go back like that so you have to do that again. And every time I read about the Israelites doing this, can I tell you the picture that comes to my mind? September the 11th, 2001. We hear about that often. All we've got to do is say 9/11, and immediately people probably remember where you were at. I can tell you where I was at. I was in the basement of my house doing work down in my basement when I got the word of what had happened. And on that day, just a shy under 3,000 people were killed when those two planes hit those twin towers. People immediately began to think, what's happening? Is God dealing with us? I mean, we've never had really anything happen like this probably since Pearl Harbor. What's God trying to do? And can I tell you, for the next 2 or 3 months, churches were full. People went to church. But then the event begins to die down a little bit. The emotions begin to subside a little bit. And then people began to do other things instead of go to church. They began to just kind of use church as, well, it's not our first priority. We'll just, we'll do whatever we want to, but no big deal. And something that immediately was at the top has now been relegated to a 4, 5, or 6 position. Why? Because we turned again to our folly. What is revival? Well, you can get all kind of definitions about revival. I really believe that what revival is it's a moving of God in the hearts of people. Most of the time in the South, when we talk about revival, we talk about evangelism. And I think that's certainly a huge part of it. Because you see the move of God, and God works in the hearts of unsaved people, but he also works in the hearts of saved people. I love reading about the Welch Revival. Took place in the early 1900s in Wales. Most people credit that revival with beginning with a man named Evan Roberts. Evan Roberts was just a young man, but he met the Lord and he had a heart for the Lord. And when people would see him, even though he had been working in the coal mines, they said, "You ought to go to seminary." And so when he was 26 years old, he went to seminary. He hadn't been there long, and he heard about a Bible conference, and he thought, you know, I'd like to go to that, but it's right during my school. So he went to the principal of the school, and you go, "Principal? That sounds like elementary school." Well, years ago, a principal was even into seminaries. So he went to his principal, and when he got there, he told him, he said, I need to miss classes if I can so that I can go to this Bible conference. And the principal said, you know, he said, "You'll probably get more from that conference than you will sitting in class, and so I'm going to give you permission to go." And so he left. And as he went there, he began to hear these old preachers begin to preach about being bent for God. Bent for God. And what they meant by that was that when God began to work in their hearts, that they were moving in a direction. It's kind of like training a tree. It's kind of like if you have a garden, you can train things to go up trellises. That's what it means in Proverbs when it says, "Train up a child in the way he should go, and when he's old, he will not depart from it." The word "train" there has the idea of pressure to bend toward a certain direction. You go out in your yard and you take a little small tree and you put a little cable around it or a rope around it, and you pull it into a direction and fasten it to the ground. It won't be too long before that tree begins to grow that way. And so these old timers would preach and they would say, "You need to be bent for God, young man." And he began to say, "Okay, I'll do that." And God began to work in his heart, and God began to really burden him about revival. When he got home, his parents thought he'd been kicked out of school because he had such a solemn look on his face. And he said, no. He said, "I'm okay." He said, "It's just as though God's doing something in my heart." And so finally, he went back and he withdrew from the seminary. And he just began to go around Wales and began to preach. And during this Welsh revival, there was 150,000 people that got saved. And anywhere that this young man would go preach, he had 4 points. And he would say this. He would say, first, number one, you must confess your known sins and you must make all your wrongs right. In other words, if you want to be bent for God, you need to confess your known sins, and if you wrong someone, you make it right. Number two, you got to put away any doubtful habits. In other words, if you're doing something and there's any doubt about it, stop. Number three, obey the Holy Spirit promptly. If you're prompted by the Holy Spirit to do something, you obey immediately. And number four, you must confess your faith publicly. In other words, you tell people that you're a Christian. Those four things are what he would preach, and that started that Welsh revival, and 150,000 people came to Christ because of it. A newspaper man went down and was in the area where he was at, and he began to ask around, "Tell me about this revival. Tell me about this revival. Can you tell me, you know, where it started?" That was the question they were asking people. And he asked a policeman, he said, "Can you tell me where this Welsh revival is?" Said the policeman stood up and poked out his chest. He tapped his heart and he said, "It's right in here." Can I tell you that's where your revival will start? It'll start in here. If you're going to have a personal revival in your life, it starts inside. And if I'm going to have a personal revival, it's going to start inside. But if we'll let it all start inside of us, then God can begin to bless us and God can begin to revive us again. But let's remember those four things that this young man used in his revival. Let's stand together.